Well, the president said calmly, before you threaten James Reese, you might want to do some research. Had you ever looked him in the eye, you'd rethink your approach. Before he could respond, the line went dead. The president had ended the call and left Edward Thwaite holding an empty phone. President Christensen folded his hands and brought them together in quiet contemplation. Visions of two American cities burning, possibly a third, haunted him. Innocent men, women, and children incinerated. 500,000 killed on his orders to save 280 million others. He thought of Lincoln, over 800,000 dead on his watch. A country divided, a country at war with itself. Christensen would be responsible for almost as many American deaths in seconds as Lincoln was in 4 years of civil war. You must save the country by killing 500,000 of your fellow citizens. How do you live after making that kind of a decision? If you don't, you are responsible for 280 million deaths. Preventable deaths. The president swiveled in his chair and looked out at the Rose Garden, then closed his eyes. His predecessor had told him it was lonely at the top. He had been right. Did Senator Thwaite really know something about James Reese and his connection to the president's personal mission? Or did he just say that to get through the barriers and connect to the president to pressure him to order the virus eradication option? Was Thwaite linked to the video and media spin of Reese's engagement in Maryland? It was no secret that the senator felt Christensen had stolen the election. If Christensen ordered the destruction of Aurora and Richardson, he was finished politically. If he didn't give the order, not only was he finished politically, but the entire country was at risk of infection from a disease with a 90% mortality rate. Either way, his presidency would be a single term. One decision to save millions of lives at the expense of two cities. Unless what? Unless Reese could prove the theory conjured up by a doctor at the CDC, whose idea was not based on science but upon conjecture and airline manifests. The president had cut as much red tape as he possibly could. Bypassing all established protocols with a direct line of communication to Reese through the CIA's Special Activities Center. As soon as he received word on the possibility the virus was an aerosolized version of Marburg variant U, he had immediately ordered a briefing. He was still waiting on confirmation that the military had an original sample of Marburg variant U. In a system of government as top-heavy as the United States, even the president had to wait. All his senior medical advisors agreed that the science pointed to a natural hemorrhagic outbreak in Angola that was now spreading rapidly on U.S. soil. The high infection rate of hospital workers caring for the sick and dying seemed to verify that assertion. He did not have time to wait on an inept bureaucracy for answers. If the virus was spreading, as the experts believed, he had no choice but to eradicate it before it killed 90% of the country. If it wasn't, he needed to know now. Christensen turned back to his desk and hit the button connecting him to his receptionist, who worked just feet from the Oval Office. Alice, connect me to Vic Rodriguez at the CIA. Chapter 61. Fairfax, Virginia. Well, how do you want to play this? Reese asked. They had landed at Dulles, where the agency also kept a fleet of Tahoes and Suburbans at the ready, and had pulled up to the curb outside of Haley's Fairfax, Virginia home. The modest split-level house was built on a corner lot surrounded by trees and not overly close to the neighbors. The first level was brick and housed a single-car garage at the end of a short driveway. A row of hedges obscured a screened-in, well-lit front porch. The second level's vinyl siding looked like it had been dropped on as an addition by someone more concerned with functionality than aesthetics.
Just as we discussed, let me go in. I'll explain. My husband is more doctor than colonel, if that makes sense to you.
It does. Let's hope the doctor part is on duty today.
I'll break it down for him, and then I'll open the door, and you can come in. But listen to me. No guns, no jujitsu, just logical and pragmatic discussion.
Check.
What does that mean?
10-4. Understood.
Okay, then. Wait here.
Reese watched Haley walk up the drive. Motion-activated lights illuminated the darkness as she passed the garage, stepped up onto the porch, and entered her home. The street was silent. Even without a mandatory curfew or lockdown orders, citizens were self-isolating in their homes. The uncertainty surrounding the new virus coming so quickly on the heels of the COVID-19 restrictions had beaten a traditionally fiercely independent citizenry into submission.
Maybe it's just an overabundance of caution, Reese thought. I hope that's all it is.
Reese kept his head on a swivel. If the president delayed dropping the FAEs on Aurora and Richardson and the virus was, in fact, a respiratory-spread airborne virus, then almost 300 million Americans would die. The commander-in-chief couldn't delay while a bureaucracy figured out the ramifications of admitting to the world that the United States had an active biological weapons program in violation of international law. By the time pulling back the curtain was approved, if it was approved, the fate of the country would already be sealed. With cases popping up in Atlanta, the countdown timer was almost at 0 hour. Reese looked from shadow to shadow, wishing he had a set of nods and a thermal. He had the shotgun from Colorado in the back seat of the Tahoe, but contrary to popular belief, CIA operatives didn't typically run around the country with issued weapons. The paramilitary officers and contractors of Ground Branch applied for their concealed carry permits just like everyone else. Reese reached back for the Remington and slid it muzzle down on the passenger side floor mat with the stock leaning against the seat next to him. At the first opportunity, Reese would get back to his safe and rearm. Being without a pistol was disconcerting. Reese saw the door open and Haley gestured to him to come up.
Here we go.
Reese looked at the 870.
No guns, no jujitsu.
He exited the car and walked up the driveway to the house.
Come in, Reese. Tom just went to get a notepad and pen. He's a planner.
The first floor of the house looked like it had been constructed well before open floor plans had become the norm. The wood floor creaked just inside the threshold. Reese noticed a sitting area to his left with a large easy chair in the corner. The wall that was visible to Reese was adorned with shelves full of books. Reese heard footsteps in the hallway and turned to shake hands with the doctor. Instead of a handshake, Reese found himself staring into the working end of a .45 caliber 1911 pistol. Chapter 62.
Tom, I told you Reese is one of the good ones.
Reese slowly moved his hands to what police officers refer to as the interview stance. Hands up at about shoulder level, palms out to give the illusion of being non-aggressive and unarmed. In reality, it was a fighting stance.
Easy, Colonel, Reese said, his mind naturally calculating distance to target, type of weapon, and additional threats.
Tom, put that thing away,
Haley said.
Please listen to her, Dr. Garrett. I'm not here to hurt anyone. We need to talk.
Reese noted that the colonel's finger was on the trigger. Normally that would be an issue, but the thumb safety was still up. Reese was not dealing with a gunman.
Haley, come over here behind me, the colonel said.
His left hand held a cell phone.
Mr. Reese, you are all over the news tonight. I have to call the police.
News? Reese asked.
Yeah. Video of murders in Maryland, Chicago, and Atlanta.
Tom, Haley said, jumping in. I was with Reese and Katie after they were attacked in Maryland. It certainly wasn't murder.
I don't know what it is, but I'm calling the police.
Please don't do that, doctor, Reese said in an even measured tone.
And why not?
Because if you do, you're sealing the fate of 500,000 Americans, citizens of the country you serve. Let's put down the pistol
and talk. If by the time we finish you still want to call the police, then there is nothing I can do. You are the last hope the people of Aurora and Richardson have." Colonel Garrett's eyes went from Reese to Haley and back to Reese.
"Haley explained what you want me to do,"
Garrett said, keeping the pistol pointed at Reese.
"A sample of the Marburg variant? You, are you insane? If we had a sample, and I am not saying we do, it would be classified and for research purposes only."
"Tom, if there is a sample at Fort Detrick, I need it to do a genomic sequence analysis and an EM comparison," Haley said. "Imagine what would happen with an official request. How long would it take to get what would be a denial of even having it when a sample is stored 50 miles from here and can prove that what's happening in Aurora and Richardson is an aerosolized Marburg variant U bioweapon and not a respiratory spread airborne virus?"
"I didn't say we have a sample."
"But if you did, how could we get it?" Reese asked.
"You are talking about stealing a bioweapon that the United States denies having. A weapon that would put us in violation of several international treaties, of which the country is a signatory."
"That's right," Reese confirmed. "Think about your oath as a doctor."
"Over my oath to country,"
Garrett countered. "Doctor," Reese said, intentionally not using Garrett's rank to frame his position. "This is about saving lives. Your oaths to your profession and to the nation support this action. Imagine, a bioweapon developed in the Soviet Union to destroy this country can now be used for the exact opposite of its intended purpose. It can save two American cities and prevent a disaster unprecedented in American history. It's up to us. No one else is coming. No one else can stop this."
"Tom, please," Haley said.
"Do you realize that assuming this virus from the Cold War was weaponized into aerosolized bacteria and was capable of targeted deployment, and assuming a Fort Detrick lab contained a potential sample of Marburg variant U, you are asking me to commit treason, be court-martialed, and to spend the remainder of my life in Leavenworth? Treason, Haley."
"Dr. Garrett, I'm going to slowly reach in my pocket, okay?" Reese stated. "I'm going to take out a phone and make a call."
"I don't understand," Garrett said, raising the 1911.
"I think this will help," Reese said, taking out a small flip phone.
"Who are you calling, Reese?" Haley asked.
Reese deliberately opened the phone with his left hand, keeping the right one up to signify that he was not a physical threat. He pressed in a memorized 10-digit number and held it up to his ear. On the second ring, the phone connected.
"Sir, it's Reese. We are close. I need you to verify and condone." To Garrett's questioning look, Reese held out the phone.
"Colonel Garrett, the President of the United States would like a word."
Chapter 63. Colonel Garrett's first call after his conversation with the president was to his research partner, Major Courtney Burke. The second was to the lab security supervisor at Fort Detrick. The third was to John Culpepper, the lab's lead animal technician. It was out of the ordinary to plan an unscheduled experiment in a Level 4 biocontainment facility on a weekend. Stranger still when that facility housed the Bat Cave. Garrett dialed Major Burke. They were seated around a small round kitchen table. Reese hadn't noticed any pictures of children or the toys that go along with them. They were alone.
"Courtney, it's Tom. I just received a call from General Keating. He's concerned about the results from the last trial, inconclusive, and with everything going on in Texas and Colorado, he's getting pressure to do an Ebola Zaire respiratory spread test to compare to past results."
"Yep. Tomorrow morning, 0600. Thanks, Courtney. Have a good night. See you in the morning."
"Think she bought it?" Reese asked.
"Let's hope so," Garrett replied. "These are unprecedented times, so it's conceivable." This isn't a request coming completely out of the blue. I think we are good. It's still the military, after all. General to colonel to major. Even in the medical corps, we remain rigidly flexible. Colonel in the SEAL teams, we would red cell different bases and facilities. I think you can call me Tom now. We are about to steal a bioweapon together, after all. And what does red cell mean? All right, Tom. Red Cell was originally a team of SEALs that tested security on military installations. I think I remember reading a book about it. You probably did. They did their job a little too well. Got in a bit of trouble, if I recall. That they did. The term is now used to reference thinking about a problem from the enemy's point of view. If you were a terrorist, how would you strike? Ah, I see, Dr. Garrett said. So, in this case, you have been going into these secure Level 4 biocontainment facilities for years. Have you ever thought through how you or how an adversary would gain access? Garrett nodded his head. Okay, let's start there, Reese said. And remember, it's important to think like a terrorist.
Chapter 64 National Biodefense Analysis and Countermeasures Center, Fort Detrick, Maryland. At 0530, Tom Garrett pulled his Jeep Cherokee up to the front gate of Fort Detrick. He rolled down his window and handed the contracted security officer his military identification. The guard force was an assortment of military police and private security contractors. The portly guard was dressed in a blue shirt and dark pants to give him the illusion of being a police officer, replete with a gold badge on the front of his black plate carrier.
"Morning, Colonel,"
he said, scanning Dr. Garrett's ID with an RFID scanner.
"Morning," Garrett responded.
Reese and Haley held up their military IDs. The guard nodded. Haley had a military ID as a dependent, and Reese had one as part of his CIA alias credentials package. Despite being the site of the National Biodefense Analysis and Countermeasures Center and the United States Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases, Fort Detrick was a military base, like any other. It had a gym, fire department, PX, commissary, barracks, and housing. Those with the proper identification could come and go as they would on any other military base. Things took a decidedly different turn in the facilities that the United States government denied even existed. Accomplishing their mission in those secure areas would require some ingenuity. The colonel dropped Reese and Haley off at the base gym. They were dressed in workout clothes and looked like anyone else out for a run to start the day. Garrett had loaned Reese some ill-fitting and brightly colored workout attire. Fort Detrick had recently amended its reflective belt policy. Soldiers were now free to go for a run without the belts if they were wearing bright-colored clothing. Garrett didn't have reflective belts, so Reese and Haley were dressed in a way that would pass inspection from an overzealous first sergeant looking to bolster his ego on an early Saturday morning.
"You ready?" Reese asked.
"Yes, just don't hurt anyone."
"Let's go."
They made their way to a grassy area for a pre-run stretch, keeping their eyes on Porter Street for a red, lifted Ram 2500 truck belonging to Fort Detrick's lead animal handler. Traffic was light on a Saturday morning, even lighter with most people at home glued to their televisions, watching the unrest in and around the containment zones. At just before 6:30 a.m., a large 4x4 lumbered down the main road in front of the gym and turned left onto Friedman Drive.
"That's him," Reese said. "Give him a minute to get settled, and then it's go time."
Colonel Garrett and Major Burke passed the four airlocks within the biocontainment Level 4 area, going through what to them was a routine process of preparing their bodies and minds for their experiment. Their naked skin was first washed in a warm, soapy spray, then in UV light. They donned their disposable bunny suits and finally zipped themselves into the impervious rubber of their bioprotective suits and attached the power cords and oxygen hoses that served as their lifelines.
They moved to their assigned alphanumeric keypads against the false wall and entered their 7-digit access codes. Colonel Garrett half expected the green light to instead blink red, but it recognized the code and permitted the doctor to move to the next phase of the access sequence. He looked into a small keyhole camera as Major Burke did the same, a laser biometrically scanning their faces. With identities confirmed and access granted, their clearances were reviewed by a guard at a remote site, who then hit a button to allow them into the inner sanctum of bioweapons research. The guard watched, as he had thousands of times before, as the two researchers passed into the Batcave and beyond the reach of video cameras. What happened behind those doors was known only to those who entered. Compartmentalization was used to prevent the right hand from knowing what the left hand was doing. Need to know and various levels of classification were part of the protections that safeguarded America's best-kept secrets. Those walls and barriers also prevented assorted agencies of the federal government from communicating in the lead-up to 9/11. Unable to share intelligence and information, those protective barriers allowed terrorists from abroad to enter the country and take flying lessons. Now Reese was going to use that same compartmentalization to steal one of the deadliest pathogens in existence. He and Haley jogged on the sidewalk not far from the gym, looking like any normal couple getting in some exercise before the commissary opened for business. Beneath a fluorescent zip-up windbreaker to ward off the cold, Reese wore a fanny pack they had pulled from the back of a closet at the Garrett's home. Inside were his marshal credentials, zip ties, duct tape, and the 1911 that Colonel Garrett had held on him the night before. It turned out to be a gift from his father. Colonel Garrett had shot it once with his dad, and then packed it away in a box. Reese had given it a quick clean and done a function check. It was loaded with 230 grain full metal jacket 45 ACP. When Reese shook it, it had rattled. That was part of the beauty of the old school 45s. The parts were interchangeable on a battlefield far from home. Reese trusted that the one he carried would work. He just hoped he wouldn't have to take any long shots. Colonel Garrett had sketched out a detailed diagram of the animal research facility that was separate but attached to the National Biodefense Analysis and Countermeasures Center. Its security cameras were a closed-circuit network to prevent animal rights activists from somehow hacking the system to show the world what was taking place on the grounds of Fort Detrick. On a Saturday, there would be 5 people assigned to the one experiment. 2 security guards would monitor the closed-circuit cameras while 3 animal technicians would sedate the primate and load it onto the stainless steel tray for delivery into the Level 4 laboratory. As Reese and Haley approached the parking area that Tom Garrett had sketched out, Reese looked at his watch. "They should be inside. Let's do this." They veered off the sidewalk and over a grassy mound, dropping down onto the parking lot of an unmarked building that was a non-human primate housing and quarantine facility. 5 cars were in the parking lot near a loading dock of what looked like a warehouse. Reese and Haley bounded up the steps to a back entrance and stopped by a steel door with a camera attached above. Reese removed his marshal's creds and held them up to the camera. He took a last look at Haley and knocked on the door. Chapter 65. John Culpepper had been an animal handler for almost 30 years. His wife and kids thought he was a veterinarian assistant attached to a benign animal research institute run by the U.S. Army. None of them knew that he cared for primates that were part of a top-secret bioweapons development program. Culpepper didn't exactly know that himself, but after all these years, he had his suspicions. He had signed non-disclosures and had to submit to a periodic background investigation, but that was the extent of it. He knew that once a month trucks arrived in the middle of the night with primates from a facility in Texas. He would supervise the transfer to their new facility, where he would care for them until he was given instructions to prepare one for delivery to the National Biodefense Analysis and countermeasures center next door. He liked to believe the research was vital to national security. Even so, knowing what would happen to them, it was never easy to sedate one of the strong animals and load it onto the tray. After that, the system was automated. He knew the body would be incinerated after the experiment. Once loaded onto the tray, he'd never see the primate again. Coming in on a Saturday was not normal, but these were anything but normal times. He'd been expecting it. Though he didn't know what went on at the end of the incineration tunnel, he knew it had to do with infectious diseases. He had read enough online over the years to know that the Army was probably developing vaccines to protect soldiers from contagious viruses in the more tropical parts of the world. He said hello to Carl and Scott, who watched the cameras to make sure the primates were all in their cages. Someone monitored the cameras 24/7. If they noticed a problem, they had a flowchart to follow with an associated phone tree. More often than not, those calls went to John and the veterinarian. Most of the time, it was because an animal got sick and had to be either treated or euthanized so as not to infect the entire population. Carl was engrossed in the latest Brad Thor thriller and would glance up from time to time to observe the screens. Scott hit pause on his iPhone long enough to say hello. He was listening to a Joe Rogan podcast where the podcaster was somehow discussing psychedelic drugs and bow hunting with Cam Haines in the same episode. A small locker room was attached to the security station. Here John and his two subordinate animal technicians changed into the PPE they were required to wear when handling the primates. A white lab coat over a tan flight suit, steel-toed shoes, a surgical mask with clear plastic goggles, and arm-length, bite-resistant gloves of Kevlar and stainless steel mesh to prevent an animal from breaking the skin if they attacked. His PPE was designed to protect from the physical threat of animals whose strength was four times that of a human. Even when the animals were sedated, the National Research Council mandated that technicians be protected, just in case. When they were ready and had buddy-checked one another to ensure they were all following the proper safety protocols, he let Carl know he was going in. Carl looked up from his book and gave a little wave before turning his attention back to the page. John unlocked a nearby door and descended the metal-grated staircase. The next step was to prepare the sedative and tranquilizer guns for their mission. The baboons were housed in single stainless steel cages to help prevent the spread of disease. Referred to as NHPs, or non-human primates, in the scientific community, the facility received 10 of them a month, which was far fewer than most of the research facilities around the country. It was John's job to care for the animals before they were sent to their deaths. It gave him no pleasure. Instead, he took pride in keeping the facility clean, the animals healthy, and being skilled in administering the anesthesia to sedate them for transport. As he prepared the long stick that would allow him to inject the animal through the bars of its cage, Walter and Chris removed the tranquilizer guns that acted as backup in case the animal somehow awoke from the sedation and attacked. Carl had seen it early in his career. A baboon had been given an ineffective dose of ketamine and sprung to life on the way to the incinerator, almost killing a female animal handler and disfiguring her face for life. He thought about that day every time he approached a cage to do his job.
"You guys all set?"
he asked.
"Ready,"
Chris said.
"Good to go," Walter confirmed.
"Let's do this and get home. It's my three-year-old's birthday today. My wife put together a little playdate for this afternoon. If I know what's good for me, I better be there."
"Ha! Smart man," John agreed. "One sedation and transport, and we will get you out of here. Keep those trank guns out of sight. You know how the other animals hate seeing them."
"We know. You tell us that every time we do this," Chris reminded the senior technician.
"Just habit."
John visually inspected his technicians before exiting the prep station and approaching specimen 8462, to begin the process that would end its life.
"Tom, what are you doing?"
Major Burke asked, her digitized voice cutting through the silence of the Batcave. Colonel Garrett was manipulating the controls of the mechanical arm that allowed him to access the pathogens behind the thick plexiglass barrier. He had opened a plastic composite freezer and extracted a vial labeled MVU-874.
"Colonel, that's Marburg,"
Courtney said, her pen hovering over the stainless steel clipboard.
"I know, Major. There was a slight change today. General Keating wants this done."
"Colonel, today's experiment was for Ebola."
"We need a comparison to the inconclusive Ebola results. I've got a hunch about this."
"A hunch? Colonel, what's going on?"
his confused partner asked.
"We will get the paperwork sorted out," he said, trying to buy time as he extracted the Marburg variant U and maneuvered the mechanical arm toward the sedated baboon.
"Sir, we can't do this."
Perspiring profusely inside his suit, Garrett wished he could wipe the sweat from his brow. He hadn't felt claustrophobic in a suit in years. His hand shook as he tried to focus on the injection.
"Tom, come on! This is not right! What are you doing?"
With no cameras or recording devices in the Batcave, Major Burke's options were limited. The protocols and security measures were based around two-person integrity, clearances, and background checks. They were specifically designed to get an extremely limited number of people into a small space to conduct experiments not officially condoned by the U.S. government, experiments that were in direct violation of the 1972 Biological Weapons Convention.
"Sir,"
Courtney said more forcefully. Colonel Garrett's next action caused Courtney to drop the clipboard and pen and step toward the exit. Instead of using the arm to move the baboon to the observation cage, Colonel Garrett left him lying on the delivery tray. He moved to a separate control panel and hit a series of override switches designed for testing the incinerator. Major Burke watched in horror as her superior officer returned their test subject to the anteroom without initiating the cremation cycle.
"What in God's name have you done?"
John confirmed that the primate had successfully been transported to its destination. The only communication John's facility had with the lab was through the machine that delivered and then incinerated the test subjects. This experiment was scheduled to take 2 hours. John and his two subordinates would clean areas around the other cages and then wait in the break room until the tray returned. They would then visually confirm that it was disinfected and ready for experiments next week before signing the paperwork confirming that NHP subject 8462 had been successfully incinerated. As John and his crew turned to tend to the cages, a red light began to blink on the wall next to the incinerator.
"What the hell?" John said. "What's going on?" Walter asked. "They done already?"
John studied the display on the terminal in front of him.
"This can't be.
We're not scheduled to do an incineration test inspection, are we?"
Chris asked from over his boss's shoulder.
"No,"
John said, looking down at his paperwork in confusion.
"Then what's happening? The tray is coming back, but it shouldn't for another 2 hours.
Maybe the paperwork got messed up," Walter offered.
"No, we don't do override tests with an animal in the lab."
"Could they have hit the wrong button on the other side?"
Chris asked.
"I guess it's possible.
The animal will be on the other side for a couple hours. Let's get back to the control room and figure this out."
As they turned to go, the control room door opened. A man and a woman in workout gear rushed down the short flight of stairs. John looked at them in disbelief. This was a first. The ramifications of what was happening didn't become clear until the bearded man hit the landing and approached, a 1911 pistol in his outstretched hand. When Reese and Haley exited the building less than 10 minutes later, 5 men were zip-tied and duct-taped in the facility break room. The infected baboon had been sent back into the crematorium for incineration, and Haley had a capped, triple-bagged syringe filled with 5 milliliters of blood. Blood that was infected with the original Soviet strain of Marburg variant U. Chapter 66. Centers for Disease Control Laboratory, Washington, D.C.
Reese, we are on the clock.
I know. Let's do this.
There is no way you can come in with me,
Haley responded.
I'm going into a biohazard level 4 containment lab. You need badges, clearances, and approvals, which you obviously don't have. I am going in with this sample of Marburg variant U and will compare it with our samples from Richardson and Aurora. If the virus samples match variant U, then we know it's not a respiratory spread infection.
And if it doesn't match?
If it doesn't match, the president only has one option.
Be careful.
I will, Reese. To my knowledge, no one has ever stolen a bioweapon from Fort Detrick,
Haley said.
My husband is probably in an interrogation room right now. Someone is going to start putting the pieces together. If we are wrong, we are going to jail for a long time.
And if we are right, two cities will still be standing this afternoon.
We will know soon, if I can get in there and pull this off.
So I just wait in the car?
Yes. I will do this as fast as I can. If the weaponized Marburg variant U is a genomic match to the samples from Texas and Colorado, we can get that information to the president, and he can rescind the eradication order.
As Haley exited the vehicle, Reese leaned across the seat. Haley.
Yes.
Good luck.
I thought you had a thing about luck,
she said, smiling to break the tension. I do, but in this case I'll take it.
What the hell were they doing at Fort Detrick?
Thwaite yelled into the phone.
We don't know, Senator. My surveillance team did not have access to the base.
And where are they now?
The CDC office is in Virginia. Have they made any calls?
Not since this morning. Fuck, Sawyer!
You find out what they are up to. For all we know, they are terrorists and have released the virus themselves.
That seems unlikely, Senator.
Listen to me. Reese meets with the president, is at the site of a suspicious death in Chicago, murders a Muslim man in Atlanta, and kidnaps his girlfriend, where now, by the way, we have infected patients. He then executes 2 Muslim men on the side of the road in Maryland, flies to Denver, where your team is unable to follow him, flies back to D.C. and is now sneaking around at Fort Detrick in the CDC labs? He's involved somehow.
What if this disease is not airborne?
It is airborne, Sawyer. All the experts agree. The deadline is upon us. The only chance to save the country, possibly the world, is here.
It might be too late already.
If the patients in Atlanta were not locked down in time, we are done for. It's all over. Think of your family, Eric. Dead. All dead.
And if the virus is eradicated, no one will ever know if it was airborne. Your path is paved into the White House.
This is not about that, Eric, and you know it. This is about saving the Republic.
How patriotic.
Something is not adding up here, Eric. Find out what Reese and his doctor friend are up to, and find out now.
2 excruciating hours later, Haley emerged from the CDC building. Reese half expected her to be in handcuffs, escorted by federal agents in dark blue windbreakers. He looked around the parking lot for signs that he was being set up. He scanned the windows in the floors above that would give snipers a clear shot, looking for anything that might indicate a hastily established urban hide site.
Nothing. But if they are good, you'll never see them coming. An HRT sniper could have you in his sights right now.
Haley rounded the front of the vehicle and slid in across from Reese. Even though it was cool, he saw the beads of sweat on her temples. She clasped her hands together to steady her nerves.
Are you all right?
Reese asked.
It's Marburg. It's variant U.
Jesus,
Reese whispered.
Where is it now? It's in the lab. It's locked in a safe. I sent all the documentation to Vic via email. I want this sample destroyed, but for now we need to keep it as evidence.
Just so I have it straight, this confirms that the virus in Colorado and Texas is a weapon. We have that weapon in our arsenal and can prove that it spreads only through direct aerosol droplets from a pressure source.
That's right, Reese. It only spreads via an aerosolized cloud, a man-made cloud. After the intentional release, it spreads the same way as any standard hemorrhagic virus.
Through direct blood-to-mucous membrane contact, correct?
Correct. It's incapable of human aerosolization like COVID-19. That's why it's the perfect bioweapon under lock and key at Fort Detrick. It strikes with incredible efficiency, but only against a targeted population center. That way it doesn't infect the planet.
And you sent everything to Vic?
I did. I followed up with a call from my desk. He said the director is assembling a team for an emergency meeting at the White House, and he wants me there to brief the president.
Well, let's go.
He also said something else.
Oh? Reese asked.
He said we have a problem. That secure phone you've been using? It's compromised.
Chapter 67.
I can't believe you agreed to this.
It was actually my idea,
Haley said as Reese drove toward the off-site CIA building in Chantilly, Virginia.
It wouldn't work if you left the CDC without me. I just asked myself, what would James Reese do?
That's a dangerous question. I think we've been spending too much time together, Reese said with a smile.
Look, we pull into the parking lot. They are expecting us. I'm going to sprint inside. Vic will have a team ready to pounce. He said it was the same team I met at the Annapolis house plus some guy named Beast or something.
Ox.
That's it, Ox,
Haley confirmed. I still don't like it. They could hit us between here and Chantilly, Reese said, his eyes in constant motion.
Just a few more minutes, Reese. Almost there and we are home free.
You know, Haley, you would have made a good team guy. Haley couldn't help but laugh.
Senator, we intercepted a call between our subject, James Reese, and the director of the CIA's Special Activities Center, Vic Rodriguez.
Well, what did they say? Thwaite asked, through his Kryptol phone.
Reese said they have proof that this outbreak is a bio-attack, something that infects via an aerosolized spray that cannot be secondarily spread, Sawyer reported.
What kind of idiocy is that? It's in three different cities. People who never came into physical contact are dying of it. That means it is airborne. We are getting cases in Atlanta, for Christ's sake.
I can only report what I've heard.
Where are they going now? The clearly agitated senator asked.
They are bringing their evidence to an office park in Chantilly, Virginia.
Sawyer, they are obviously involved in this plot. They are terrorists themselves. Hell. James Reese was labeled a domestic terrorist by the FBI. He's clearly finishing what he started all those years ago. He wants to bring down the country he blames for the deaths of his family and his SEAL troop. It's your job to prevent that from happening.
He's in a new vehicle, so we don't have him under electronic surveillance, but we know where he's going.
Well, take him out. Save the country.
The office park is a CIA processing facility.
Fucking CIA is involved too, then. Sawyer, you take them out. Save the country. I will not let 200 years of blood, sweat, and tears be destroyed by a domestic terrorist. Kill Reese and the doctor. Help me save the world.
Holy shit, did I hear that right? We get to kill James fucking Reese?
Woody asked.
That's the order. And the doctor, Crimmins confirmed.
Well, fuck me. How illegal is this?
It's a national emergency. Apparently they are involved with the shit in Texas and Colorado.
The virus?
Yeah.
We are going to take down a terrorist SEAL. Oh, shit! Think they'll put me on the cover of Recoil?
Probably, if you pay them enough. You ready to finally be a hero, Worthless?
I'm already a fucking hero, brah. Now I get to add Killer of James Reese to my resume,
Woody said, press-checking the AR from the back of the minivan.
Just be ready, and don't fucking miss.
I don't miss, bro.
I hope not.
It's just up ahead. Reese said, looking in his rearview mirror and noting the dark minivan that changed lanes a few cars back. Are you ready?
I'm ready,
Haley said. Okay, then. Vic has cleared the parking lot except for a few vehicles to make it look occupied. The building is locked down, so no one is coming in or out. Your path to the front door is clear. Haley shifted nervously in her seat. Seatbelt on? Reese asked.
It's on.
We're going to turn in behind them and pull right next to them as they park, Crimmins said.
Fuck yeah, then I pop the door and take them out.
Just remember to take the safety off, Crimmins advised.
Fuck you, Charlie. I know what I'm doing. We did low-vis vehicle interdiction black ops in the stand.
Sure you did. Just remember the safety. Reese slowed the Cherokee and turned into the office park that operated as the processing center for the CIA's clandestine service, watching closely as the minivan pulled in behind them.
Hold on, Haley.
Just inside the parking area, Reese paused as if he was looking for a place to park. Then he slammed the vehicle in reverse and stepped on the gas.
What the fuck?
Crimmins exclaimed, seeing the target vehicle's reverse lights come on and quickly accelerate toward him. By the time Crimmins's brain registered the fact that the hunters had become the hunted, it was too late. His hand put the van in reverse just as Reese's vehicle made impact with the front bumper. The impact sent Woody, who was already kneeling by the one sliding door, to the floor. Hitting the gas to reverse out, Crimmins felt a second impact and looked at the screen on the dash, seeing that a security barricade had risen behind them. The van was jammed between Reese's vehicle and the barrier. Reaching for the door handle, he abruptly stopped when a black Suburban slid to a stop, cutting off another avenue of escape. Ignoring Woody in the back of the van, yelling about a broken arm, he looked up in time to see a second Suburban skid into place in front of Reese and the doctor, trapping the minivan in a textbook L ambush. He barely registered that the passenger side door of the car had flung open. A female was sprinting from the vehicle, three men in tactical gear falling in with her to escort her to the building in front of them. Hard-looking operators emerged from the SUVs. Crimmins noticed a man in each element held an MK 48 7.62 by 51 machine gun. The others had M4 carbines with suppressors.
Maybe I can still push this thing out of the way and get us out of here.
As he put the minivan back in drive and stepped on the gas, he heard the unmistakable sound of a suppressed automatic weapon erupt to his left. Steam exploded from the engine as the open bolt machine gun tore through the hood and front quarter panel of the vehicle. Crimmins took his foot from the gas pedal and put the van in park. His hands slowly went to the wheel.
Don't give them an excuse.
Woody, put down the AR, he said.
What the fuck just happened? My fucking arm's broken.
As worthless Woody attempted to prop himself up with his one good arm, the side door opened and he found himself face to face with James Reese. Chapter 68. Russell Senate Office Building, Washington, D.C. Senator Thwaite watched the president's address from the Oval Office in disbelief. He looked so presidential and reassuring, so sure of himself. How could this be? I want to assure the American people that the end of the crisis is near. We have confirmed through exhaustive international investigations by the world's leading infectious disease specialists that this new virus is indeed a hemorrhagic fever. It originated in Angola, but has burned itself out on the African continent. It has done the same here in the United States. We have studied the Angolan virus closely and determined that it will not spread via respiratory pathways, as we saw with COVID-19. Once again, to be perfectly clear, this is not spread like the flu or COVID-19 or the common cold. We had early spikes in Aurora, Colorado and Richardson, Texas, with one-off cases in Atlanta. Since those early spikes, the curve has flattened, naturally, and current infection rates are almost at zero.
I don't believe it,
Thwaite thought. Even though it was just after noon, the senator held a drink in his quaking, clammy palms. I can now assure you that this terrible disease has taken the worst of its toll. It has impacted our society and tested us to our core. But we are Americans. We will rise above the fray. The scientific community is working on a vaccine so that if we ever face this enemy again, we will be ready. Thwaite leaned back in his desk chair.
He's actually turning this into political capital, the son of a bitch.
There have been reports that the virus was a bioweapon delivered by a foreign enemy. These reports are false. There have also been reports that the virus escaped from a lab here in the United States. Those reports are false.
What are you up to, Mr. President?
Thwaite whispered. I want to address the rumors that there are strategies in place to eradicate viruses on home soil with incendiary bombs. I want to address those rumors honestly. I recently became aware of plans put in place during the Cold War, plans that remained in place until today. Effective immediately, I have signed an executive order placing what are known as eradication measures on hold. A bipartisan commission will submit a report to me within 90 days concerning these legacy policies, with recommendations on how to proceed so that in the face of a future virus, we have other options at our disposal. I commit to you tonight, there will be full transparency in these proceedings. We will harness the power, ingenuity, and brilliance of our scientific community, technology sector, and pharmaceutical industry to develop the most effective means of combating emerging hemorrhagic viruses. You have my pledge that you, the people, will be heard, and we will move forward together, stronger and united.
This is unbelievable. He can't do this.
Our thoughts and prayers are with all of those affected by the virus and with the frontline workers who care for them. We are with you. No effort or expense will be spared to provide you with the resources you need to see this through. May God bless you, and may God continue to bless the United States of America. The video feed switched to a panel of very relieved-looking news contributors. Thwaite continued to stare at the television, not hearing a word. The phone buzzed on his desk. Slowly, he hit the intercom button to connect with his receptionist.
Isn't this wonderful news, Senator?
What?
The president's address. The virus is no longer spreading. We are going to be okay.
Yes, Karen, that's, incredible news.
Yes, sir. Well, I have a call waiting for you from the FBI. It sounds important.
The FBI?
Yes, Senator. Special Agent Andrew Klein would like to speak with you.
Please take a message. If he requests a meeting, please schedule it out as far as possible.
Yes, Senator.
Thwaite terminated the connection. Deliberately, he opened a desk drawer and removed his secure phone, looking at it skeptically. Without another viable option, he called Sawyer.
Did you see it?
I did, Sawyer responded. And I was just about to call you.
Really?
Yes. A source at the FBI has informed me that you and I are both under investigation for the attempted murder of James Reese and Haley Garrett in Virginia, along with a host of other less serious offenses.
I'm thinking now would be a good time to vacate the premises.
I'd agree with you.
Out of the country.
I'm way ahead of you. Meet me at Signature Aviation at Dulles. If you aren't there in 40 minutes, I leave without you. Thwaite dropped his Kryptol and BlackBerry into the drawer. He took one last look at the portrait of his father and then departed for the airport. Chapter 69. Embassy of Pakistan, Washington, D.C.
Hafez Qasem sat at the conference table in the secure room in the basement of the Pakistani embassy in Washington, D.C. Without taking his eyes from the box, he made a slight motion with his right hand. An administrative assistant sliced through the packaging tape and looked to the intelligence chief for further instructions. With another wave, the underling was dismissed, relieved to be out of the presence of the Iranian intelligence chief. It had been labeled a diplomatic pouch, but clearly it was not. The box had been addressed to Qasem personally, which was an anomaly. The Americans knew he operated out of the embassy and even surveilled him occasionally, as they did with all members of the Iranian staff. It was expected for adversaries and even allies to spy on one another. It was all part of the game. Qasem's job was strategy. He was no longer a tactical player. He hadn't been for a long time. The box had the return address of a UPS store in Annapolis. He observed it for any suspicious signs that should have been warnings to some of his brethren in Hezbollah and the Quds Force, when mailing death had become a popular tactic of the Israeli intelligence services. It wasn't leaking. It didn't smell. There were no protruding wires. It had been swiped for chemical residue, and the Pakistani embassy had the dogs sniff it for explosives. A company provided the service off embassy grounds so as not to offend with the filthy animals. All those tests had returned negative. It had also been x-rayed. The electromagnetic radiation had revealed the contents. Qasem knew what it was. He needed to confirm who it was. Qasem was confident it would not explode. It contained a message meant for the lead Iranian spy in the United States. Qasem stood and pushed away the cardboard to reveal the next layer. Whatever was inside had been wrapped in aluminum foil and plastic wrap. It reminded Qasem of a wrapped present the Americans were so fond of giving one another on the bastardization of the Prophet Jesus' day of birth, when Isa ibn Maryam was sent with the Injil to foretell the coming of the Prophet Muhammad. Rumin Allah, the Spirit of God. The Iranian spymaster carefully sliced through the foil with a jambiya, the traditional curved blade of his ancestors. Nizari Ismailis. Carefully he parted the shiny plastic and aluminum barrier to reveal the tan plastic top of a cooler. He worked his fingers down the front and lifted the rubber latches, continuing to inspect for wires just in case something had been missed in its prior security inspection. It was also never beyond the realm of possibility that someone in the ISI, Pakistan's intelligence service, wanted him dead. One could not be too careful in the world of espionage. All clear. Then, slowly, he opened the lid. Looking up at him was the severed head of Ali Reza Ansari. Instead of horror, Qasem studied the upturned eyes of the man he'd passed the Marburg virus to just weeks earlier. Dried ice had been packed around the head to keep it fresh, so that Qasem would have no trouble with identification. There was something peculiar about the mouth. A piece of plastic was protruding from between purple lips. Qasem pinched it between his thumb and forefinger, extracting a Ziploc bag with a single piece of paper inside. He turned it over. It read simply, September 10th.
They know.
Hafez Qasem reached for the phone on the table to his right.
Ready the plane. I will be returning to Iran tonight.
Chapter 70. Reese sat in the back of the smallest version of Mercedes's venerable Sprinter van. This one was painted white with a floral business moniker on each side. If someone Googled the business to find the website and called the listed number, they would hear a recording in which a pleasant woman's voice would explain that they were busy arranging flowers and would return the call as soon as possible. The call, of course, would never be returned. Inside it was anything but a flower delivery van. The walls, floor, and ceiling were lined in black, sound-dampening material, and there was no access to the driver's compartment. Shackles were attached to the floor and wall. A bench seat was built into the right side, and one chair was bolted into the floor.
Okay, he's departing the embassy on foot. No variation from his daily profile other than the time and the fact that his phone is still inside.
Good copy,
came Ox's voice over the encrypted radio.
You get that, White Knight?
White Knight copies, Reese said into his radio.
Just need to know if he's going home or to the airport.
He's taking Route 3, a voice informed them. The voice belonged to the UAV operator whose ISR platform had electronically tagged their target. They had been tailing Qassem for 6 days and had identified 3 routes he used to walk from his office in the Pakistani embassy to the house the Iranians rented for him through their Pakistani surrogates in the North Cleveland Park area of the city. Hitting him at the embassy was a no-go, and security at the rented apartment was run through the Pakistanis. He varied his daily routine, but one could only take so many routes home. There would always be an identifiable choke point. Choke points presented a problem when dealing with a trained intelligence operative. They knew the choke points as well as those who hunted them. That's why Reese wasn't going to hit him at a choke point. Qassem noted that pedestrians were on the streets as they emerged from self-imposed isolation and returned to businesses in the aftermath of the virus scare. Some 5,872 Americans had died from the virus, most of those in Aurora and Richardson, with a few isolated cases in Atlanta. Ali, having to use the remote dispersal device, had hurt their numbers. Releasing the virus in high-traffic areas before hitting the hospitals had been a stroke of genius. It had been Ali's idea, and reinforced to the scientific community, that medical staffs were getting it from patients just by breathing the same air. Another 257 people had died in clashes with the military and law enforcement. In Qassem's estimation, American confidence in government, elected politicians, and the military had hit rock bottom. But unfortunately, there were glimmers of recovery. The new president was leading the country out of the pits of despair and working with Congress on an economic stimulus package focused on Colorado and Texas. Americans were a resilient lot. President Christensen had flown immediately to Texas following his address to the nation. In a video that had since gone viral, a camera crew caught Marine One making an unscheduled landing on University Park Field near the hospital in Richardson that had first reported the virus. A body bag had been removed from a refrigerated truck. It was on a gurney